Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. Today, we're going to talk about something really exciting. I know everybody's really excited about software testing. We're going to talk about QA. Our guest today is Jay Agner. He owns a company that does QA. We're going to learn all about different types of QA and testing. And, you know, even for a startup, like when should you do QA? We're going to talk about all of it today. Before we get started, I do want to remind everybody that today's episode of Startup Hustle is powered by Fullscale. Hiring software developers is difficult. Fullscale can help you build a software team quickly and affordably that works directly for you. Please visit fullscale.io to learn more. Jay, welcome to the show, man.
Matt, thanks for having me, buddy. And thank you for making testing sound exciting, because we all know.
Well, we're going to have to try today. We're going to have to try really hard for this to sound exciting.
It's okay. I mean, the business of it, I love. And the process is fun, too. You just got to, you know, you got to get into it. So,
well, I think I'm more excited to talk about the business of it. And I've seen my notes here. I saw this little story about how you got rejected by Uber. Like, you tried to work at Uber and you got rejected and you said, screw it. And you started your own company. Was that the nemesis of this?
I mean, if, you know, it sounds great.
Sounds exciting.
It sounds like a great story. But my wife's an overnight nurse, or she was an overnight nurse, and I was just trying to do anything I do to get her out of there. My license was from Virginia. I lived in Pennsylvania. Apparently that's not okay for Uber. And they said I couldn't drive for them. I was trying to do anything I could. And then I found Upwork, which started a freelance journey that turned into a, you know, a pretty successful business. So I would love to say that, like, I jumped right into starting a business, but it was more picking up jobs, doing stuff online, you know, QA testing on the side, and then eventually turned that into a business.
So when we talk about QA testing, for those who aren't familiar, we're talking about all forms of software testing, be it manual and automated, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about that today. But back to your story, though. So you were driving for Uber. You weren't doing QA. Like, Uber was your full-time job?
No, Uber was your side gig? Okay. No, neither. It was neither. I was doing QA full-time, and I was just looking for anything extra to try to make some more money, because I wanted to get my wife out of being a nurse. So I applied for Uber and Lyft, and they both said no.
And so you had a full-time job doing QA, and you decided to offer some QA services as well on Upwork, and next thing you know, you had some clients beating down your door to QA for them.
Yep. And I had a problem saying no to money, and I had to figure out how to get those contracts done, and brought in some people that I used to work with, including my old boss, and started my company.
So it all sounds real easy. You just list yourself on Upwork.
You just check the box and you're good to
start
go.
Start a business.
That's it. Not anymore, man. Upwork has changed quite a bit over the years. But it does sound easy.
Well, so How did you balance that at first? Like, were you're working 40, you know, hours a week or whatever, and then working another 40 hours a week doing this? Or how did you start the business and then like start to scale it? Like how did you work through that? Tell us the story about like the tipping point of how you go from doing this as a side hustle to making it a full-time business.
Yeah. I mean, I always tried to do it in a very risk averse way. Right. Which was like, when it was just me, it was easy. It was fine. I would go to my job. I'd come home. I'd work on stuff and just rinse and repeat. Right. And then you get an extra 20, 30, 40 hours a week. And then I started bringing in other people, and that's where it became a little more interesting. I had to kind of balance some of that stuff during the day, you know, in between lunch breaks and stepping into the stairwell for a few minutes to take a phone call. Just kind of started to build the business up that way. And I've always worked remotely, I guess not always, but I mean, I've worked remotely for the past 7 or 8 years, which makes it kind of easy to hop in and out of client calls and do whatever you have to do. So I feel like I've always given 100% to the companies that I was working 9 to 5 for. So I don't think I was shortchanging anybody, but definitely in that free time / downtime, you know, I'd get in and grow the business by bringing in new contracts, assigning off, you know, resources and kind of just growing the business that way.
Well, when people think of starting a business and they think of tech, they usually think of creating a software company and not a professional services company like you have, which is called JDA QA, by the way. I should have mentioned that earlier, which is JDAQA.com. So they think of creating a SaaS company and a product company, which, you know, you can spend like a year or two building some kind of software product and getting it to market and figuring out how to sell it. And you spend a lot of money and time and maybe never make any money, right? Like mm-hmm. getting to break even and all that, especially if you're selling some product for $100 a month or whatever, it takes forever. It's a long journey, where a professional services business like yours and like Full Scale, you know, we do software development for other people too. These kinds of professional services businesses are way easier to start from the very beginning, right? You're like, I got people that want to pay me a lot of money to do this, and I can go hire somebody to do the work, and I make my margin. I make, you know, 10%, 20%, 30%, whatever the margin is, right? And you can almost make money from day one, right? I would guess for you, it was pretty easy to make, you know, some sort of margin on it almost immediately.
Yeah. I think the key there, and I'm sure you had this experience as well, is like, you have to have expertise in something, right? Mine was in QA. So that was easy for me to consult. I kind of consider it like a very natural evolution from freelance / consulting to bringing in somebody else to do the work, to then kind of switching it over, just fully being a project-based or, you know, a service-based business that all you do is provide services to other people. I'd love to build a product, but like all the things you pointed out,
it's hard.
It's hard. And it's, you know, I think there's a reason why there's lots and lots and lots of startup failures in the SaaS space. And, you know, there's lots of failed IT services businesses as well, but I think those are for different reasons in a SaaS company.
So how long did you continue to work your full-time business before you were able to go work on JDAQA, your business, full-time?
I mean, I got away with it for a long time, man. We had probably 15 to 20 people while I still had a 9-to-5 job. I left my job for about a few months, and then I got hired by one of our clients to do chief product development officer at a fintech company. And then I worked there for about a year or two. I guess it was back in like 2019. And then eventually that kind of just didn't fit anymore, and I went out to do this full time. So I did it for a long time. I was very, you know, I kind of was double dipping for the most part, right? I mean, but doing it in a way that was fair to everybody. Like, I was not, you know, working during work hours for two companies. I was splitting it up pretty well.
Yeah.
I very de-risked way where, like, you know, keeping my 9-to-5 job. But if I look back, I probably would have left sooner. You know, I would have just done this full time years ago.
So when you were doing QA before for these companies, were you used to managing other people and doing all that sort of stuff? Or was owning your own business kind of your first, you know, experience and having to manage a bunch of people on a team?
I think it was my first real experience. I was okay. not a I was not, I mean, I was a lead, but not in a, more of in a group capacity than any sort of like, you know, being responsible for a bunch of different people. So it was new, but it somewhat came naturally to me, I think.
And was this first time entrepreneur as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody who runs a business has some story of like when they were a teenager, they did some, like I made websites for my mom's business. She had an advertising agency. And like back when the web was a new exciting thing in the 90s, I was making websites for them for $1,200 a pop. As you know, the 12-year-old, that's a 13-year-old, it's a big deal. But yeah, first official real entrepreneurship, I think, was this company.
Well, I love highlighting the story because, again, I think creating a professional service company like yours, like Full Scale, these kinds of businesses are a great option for people that nobody thinks of, right? Like if you're an expert at whatever you do, you know, you can do that for other people. But if you want to scale it, you've got to learn the skill set to hire other people and delegate to them, which sounds like you went through that over a 2 or 3 year period while still working your other job and hiring people and delegating and all that. And it's a super great idea for people that want to start their own company. Starting a SaaS company and a product company is also fun, but it's also a nightmare.
It's gotta be fun. It's gotta be fun, but terrifying, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's your money. Like it's your money you're putting out for that. For a services-based business, you're just getting money. You're not like putting it out, hoping to get it back. It's very much, like you said, the margin is there, and you have to kind of pay people to do the work.
I mean, professional services companies still take money. You know, you have a lot of employees, and, you know, if we go back to the early story of Full Scale when we started, we hired like 100 employees over the first, like, year of the business. That means I had to buy 100 laptops. I had to buy 100 desks, 100 chairs. I had to go rent a floor of a building 8,000 miles away in the Philippines to do this, right? I had to pay 3 months security deposit and 3 months rent deposit, right? Like that takes capital too. Like these, that's, you know, these kinds of businesses can take capital, right? Now, not as crazy as, you know, starting a software company, but even a professional services company can take capital.
Yeah, I would say it takes capital. I would just say you can, I mean, I think your example is a, I would say on the other side of the spectrum, mine was everybody was remote. I do have to buy devices and buy, sure, absolutely. I have to do some of that stuff, but I would say it's still within the, you know, operating expense margin kind of area of the business. And it's not like I'm not writing a check for $50,000 for a bunch of developers to go build a product, you know,
right,
maybe I spend $50,000, but that's after I've kind of made sure that I'm going to get 150 from some clients first. Right. So it's kind of balanced. It's a little de-risked, I think, compared to the SaaS world. That's all.
Well, and you've got some assets to back it, usually, you know, at least some old laptops now.
Sure. Right. Yes. Some ancient technology. Yes.
Yeah. So, let's talk more about QA and testing. And I guess my first question for you is, for a lot of the clients that you're working with, would it be surprising how many of them don't really do QA before they bring you in?
It would be shocking to know the number. You know, I don't know what the number is. You know, you would think that my job was just to sell our services, but there's a surprising amount of education sales that go along with what I do too, right? It's not just for their clients to have the product QA'd, but also for the companies that we're working with. Like, why are you having a developer who's, you're paying $100 an hour, or a project manager you're paying $75 an hour or whatever it is to do the QA? Like, why would you do that? Like, why wouldn't you have them doing more projects and more development for that same amount of money, as opposed to something that's lower cost like QA? Have somebody like us do it. So yeah, it's very surprising how many companies kind of wait as long as possible to hand that off and have somebody actually do QA, or that they just, you know, it's an afterthought and they have a small, you know, team that kind of does QA. But yeah, it's you'd be surprised.
Well, so my first company was a SaaS company. It was a product company, right? And we grew that to doing $30 million a year in revenue and sold it. And when we sold it, I had about 40 people working in software development. I don't think there was anybody that did QA. Yeah. And so I was that guy. Like, I was not a QA person. I was like, look, the developers should do a really good job of creating quality code and testing their own code. If we have to hire QA, does that mean I don't believe that my developers can produce good quality code, right? But I also understand that developers are really terrible at testing things. Let's be honest. They're terrible at it. They follow the directions. They get something that sort of works. They think it sort of works. They test the happy path. And they're like, okay, I'm done. Check it in. Deploy it to production. Yep. And then all hell breaks loose, right? So I think my mindset has shifted over time. And it really depends on the quality of developers you have too. Depends a lot on the quality of the developers you have, the type of work that you're doing, the type of product it is, all of those things, right? So I'm sure you've probably seen some big messes along the way that you've had to come in and you're QAing software that was just an absolute disaster, I would guess.
Yeah. And I mean, to your point, I think the complexity of software has just exponentially gotten higher, right? Like back in the day, right? Like when I started doing QA or just in general, things were much simpler, right? I mean, it was very like, do what they're supposed to do. Now you've got all sorts of integrations and backend pieces and APIs and all these different things that just didn't exist years ago. So we've seen some messes and we've, you know, had to sometimes bow out and just say, this environment is not conducive to doing QA or getting these things fixed, right? And it's just not a great fit for either side. So we're very realistic. We know what we can do and which clients we work well with. And I think as your business evolves, you can kind of learn to say no to some things and not take on jobs that you know are not going to be good if they're too much of a mess from the jump, right?
Well, so I want to hear more about that. What type of clients do you run into that you're like, you know what, we don't want to do business with these people? Like, I'm curious.
I would say the biggest red flag for us is companies whose leadership don't appreciate the team that they have, right? If people are talking down to their people on calls or not being good leaders, I think that translates to not good partnerships. If they're not being good bosses, if they're not being good, representation of what they want as quality of a culture in their company, those have always been the ones that don't work out. The ones you get on a discovery call, they're talking shit about their developers and their designers and whatever, and you're like, this isn't going to be a great fit. Other than that, I mean, you know, I would say infrastructure and product-wise, there's not many we don't take on, you know, because our job is to come in and say, this is a mess. We're going to help clean it up. We're going to help consult with you and kind of give you high-level strategy first and foremost of, like, what are you supposed to do to get this thing back on track? And then we implement the people in the process to do it. So it's more of a personality / leadership problem I see when we bow out.
So what I find interesting about that is it makes total sense if you're meeting with a client and they're complaining about their team, they complain about everything in the world, and you know in the back of your head that, you know what, they're just going to complain about QA. Like, QA will be the new scapegoat, and so my team is going to take a beating from these people that, you know, they wake up every day and hate themselves and hate everyone they work with and blame everybody for everything, and we're just going to be the new scapegoat.
Yep.
Right? Like, because that's the problem of being QA, right? Like, if you're doing software testing, all of a sudden your neck sort of becomes on the line of like saying that this is good. Like, it's your job now to test things and say, you know what, this is going to work and we've tested it and we're ready. So now you become the scapegoat, right? Like, you become the person who takes all the blame. And the last thing you want to do is partner with somebody who loves to blame somebody for everything.
Yeah. We like to partner with people who know they need QA, right? They just, and maybe they don't know they need QA. They just know they need a better quality product, better communication, et cetera. And like, we're going to be a good fit. But yeah, you're dead on, man. We're already the last line of defense. We're already like the last ones.
You want to be seen as the, please God, come help me be our savior. Not the, hey, we need a scapegoat. Come on in.
Yeah. Who else can we blame? Let's bring in JDAQA. No, we're, to your point though, like we are kind of, that's the role of QA in general is the last line of defense. You could test 99.999% of things. And that 0.0001 is the thing that their biggest client is going to open up and explode first. And then you're going to be, it's going to be the end of your relationship. Right. So you really got to be buttoned up when you're doing the stuff that we do.
Yep. So let me ask you this. If somebody's listening and they're an early stage startup, they're building one of these product companies that you and I have agreed are very difficult to do. How soon do you think they should be doing QA? Like if you're super early stage, when do you think QA is important? When should they start doing QA?
I think when you start to scale up, right? When you start to get past the MVP phase, you know, you've got a couple developers, you're doing stuff. I mean, it's important to get it in at any point. But you know, really when you start to go from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 developers, when you start introducing multiple sources of code commits, and when you get multiple sources of product managers and project managers, and there's opportunity for gaps to kind of form. I mean, when it's early and there's a founder and maybe a developer or two, and you're just banging stuff out and trying to get it out, like that's maybe not the time to be a perfectionist, right? Or trying to get, but you know, it depends on the product type too, right? If you're doing fintech, for example, like you don't want to put a half-baked thing out there.
Right.
If you're doing social media application, then maybe some, you know, some things here and there are not as big of a deal. If you're doing healthcare, like you don't want to screw that up, right? So it's industry-based, but also I think it's when you start to realize that number one, you as a founder shouldn't be doing QA, right? Because when you're early on, testing stuff and making sure it works is just kind of like the natural part of a founder's journey in that SaaS model. Then you start handing that off to project managers, and then you start handing that off to other people. Eventually everybody needs to be doing their own job, right? And I think there's kind of a core part, maybe 5 to 10 people, when it really starts to make sense. Okay, let's get somebody else to be doing the QA that's not biased, and you know, that's their only job.
Yeah, I had the same conversation last week with one of our teams. That it's a development team of 3 people. They're starting a brand new project. There's a brand new company, total greenfield thing. And one of our project managers said, oh, we need to add QA to the team. And my response to him was, there's nothing to QA. Like, there's literally nothing. What are we going to test? Like, we haven't wrote one line of code yet. So it's like, I don't believe you need QA like on day one. You definitely need it at some point in time. And I think you spoke really well to it. It really depends on the type of industry and the type of product and all this kind of stuff that as well. But yeah, I don't know that it makes sense to have it on the first day. You got to have something built and ready to get to market to test first. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah. And to that point, we do, after you've gotten to a certain point, you should move QA further and further up the pipe. Like if you have a product, having people who have QA'd stuff, have the QA'd that product, if you bring them into design discussions or product discussions, they can help you say, hey, remember that thing you guys made last time? It broke all these other 40 things. And like that's when the value in QA being early helps. But I agree.
Yeah.
Getting them in before there's anything built doesn't typically make sense. But you know, sometimes it can make sense.
Well, I want to remind everybody that finding expert software developers doesn't have to be difficult, especially when you visit fullscale.io, where you can build a software team quickly and affordably. You can use our platform to define what kind of developers you're looking for and see who's available to join your team today. So, Jay, something else that's interesting, just like our company Fullscale, you have a bunch of employees in the Philippines.
Yes.
Right? And tell us a little bit about, I'd love to hear from you about the talent that you found there, the employees that you have there. I'm sure similar experiences that I have, but I would love to hear your take on what it's like to have a bunch of employees and technical people working for you in the Philippines.
It's an incredible experience. They're just culturally and technically, they're phenomenal. I didn't know this until I started working with a bunch of people in the Philippines, but, you know, and maybe you do know this, that like Accenture and all these corporations that are over there, they have colleges in the Philippines. So when you want to be a QA person or a software engineer, you can go to Accenture College and you can be taught you know, all the normal stuff you would be, but then you go right into working for Accenture, making $4 an hour or whatever it is that they pay the, you know, the people over there. So we take the people who have been trained by these really great big organizations. We treat them like human beings. We bring them into our organization. We pay them well. We you know, treat them as family. And I've got, you know, all our executive assistants, all our virtual assistants, a bunch of our QA folks, a bunch of our QA leads, a bunch of different functions in the organization. I love them, and I'm jealous of your 13 trips to the Philippines. I need to get over there because I'm dying to meet some of these people in person. But yes, we absolutely love it. They're fantastic.
I didn't realize that Accenture had their own college.
Yes, I didn't either. A couple of my folks were like, "Yeah, we went to." I'm like, "You went to Accenture College? It's crazy." Yeah, they send you to college, pay for it, but it's in. You have to work for them. It's kind of like the military in that sense, where like they'll pay for it, but you got to put your time in at their company.
Well, and like you, we've hired a lot of people that worked for Accenture or several other big firms, right? It's like they work at those companies for 2, 3, 4, 5 years and ready to do something new. And they've got a lot of experience and we're able to hire them and usually pay them a lot more as well and give them some, you know, better opportunities and fun things to work on. So. Well, it's good to hear your take on that. We have 300 employees in the Philippines, mostly software development, and absolutely amazing people. And I will actually be over there in a few weeks, so I'm excited to be back over there. So I would love to hear from you more about your experience with Upwork. You mentioned earlier about Upwork. And so for those that are listening that have found people on Upwork before, it could be very useful, but I'm curious about your experience of like selling your services through Upwork. Like what is that like?
I have a love-hate relationship with Upwork. I love the business that they give me. I don't love the fees, but I don't like some of the changes they've made over the years after they went public. Typically a pretty big tipping point for a lot of these companies is when they go public because they have to start having to serve shareholders. Yeah, I mean, I got in when the getting was good, man. I got in 10 years ago, right? I actually was on Elance, I think, at first. And they got bought or merged or whatever with Upwork. And for those who don't know, you know, it's basically just an online marketplace for IT services. So I started building up my profile and have, you know, the top 1% earner profile over the last few years. And when people were searching for QA, that my face would show up. And the real interesting part of my journey, I think, for me personally, was like making that change from, yes, I'll be the one doing the work, to, no, I won't be the one doing the work, but I have a great team that will, right? Like that's a big change, especially when your face is the one on the profile. They're coming to you thinking you're going to be the guy, and you have to kind of figure out how to make this pivot. Because the agency model thing on Upwork is kind of bolted on. It was like kind of an afterthought, and it's not a great place for agencies, in my opinion, just because the functionality isn't great. But I built up the profile, but just doing jobs over the years, getting a great reviews and a bunch of 5-star reviews from everybody. And then eventually kind of made the switch from when people would message me, I'd reply back and say, we have a great team that can get this done for you. And so it's been a great place for us, man. We still get a ton of leads from there. They switched their fees model around. It used to be, you know, 5%. Now it's 10%, which isn't fun. You have to bid for contracts and stuff now, which is a little annoying. But I still tell people all the time they should check it out if they haven't been on there.
So I did a quick Google search and I found your company on there. But so do you also have like a Jay Agner profile like separately?
That's the main one. That's the main one. Yeah, that was the one that we started with. So yeah, absolutely.
So you still have your own separate personal profile?
That gets more business and traction because that's the one I built up over the last 10 years. And I'll reply back and say, hey, we have a team that'll get this done for you. So I show up when people look for QA. And at one point, you know, we were top 5, top 3. If you search for QA on Upwork at all, you know, my big dumb face would show up as, you know, somebody to do it for you.
Now, how do you stand out from the crowd though? Isn't there like hundreds or thousands, there's thousands of people in there that offer QA, I'm sure. So how do you get to be the one that shows up? Is that because you pay, like you advertise, or like how does that work?
It definitely came from getting in early, right before the rush came. I also made a decision early on not to race towards the bottom, which is very easy to do on Upwork, and people get very discouraged every time I talk to people who tried it and they didn't like it. They go, well, you know, there's a bunch of people and they're bidding, you know, for $10 an hour. Well, you don't want to work with the companies that are looking to pay, you know, $5 an hour for somebody to do QA. You don't. You want to be the guy, just like any other productized service, right? Like, you got to offer enough value to charge more money. So, you know, while people were charging 15, I was charging 45. And it was because I'm a US-based senior QA engineer with blah, blah, blah experience. And like, I was able to charge more money. And, you know, I got some big deals and big contracts that we ran through Upwork, and they don't talk about it, but there's 100% a feeding the machine piece to Upwork where, like, if you run more contracts through it, you get more business. And I don't know what the algorithm is, but there are certainly times that we run a lot of contracts through Upwork, it feeds right back and we get a lot more invitations and proposals and a bunch of other stuff. There's definitely some part of the system that knows that you're using it.
So does that mean you're running contracts through it that came from leads that didn't come through Upwork? So the leads came somewhere else?
No, just in general. Like if we have a phase where we're getting a bunch of referrals from all outside of Upwork from existing clients, and we're not using Upwork as much, we'll definitely notice a slowdown in the
okay.
But if we're in there and we're actively, you know, really pushing it, then we certainly see a lot more you know, contracts and stuff coming back to us.
So it's like the more business you do through Upwork, the more business you get from Upwork because they know they're getting like their 10% or whatever. So
yep.
they keep spinning that flywheel for you to get more and more and more.
I can't, you know, prove it, but I can prove it. I can prove it internally, but not on a report anywhere.
So one thing I want to ask you about is manual QA versus automated QA. So there's a lot of different types of QA, and I want to talk about that too. But the first thing I want to ask you about is, you know, there's definitely always work to do to manually test things and QA things. But there's also a lot of work to automate things, but it doesn't necessarily make sense to automate everything. So I'd love to get your feedback on that part of it. What should you manually test? And then what should you automate testing for? What is your opinion there?
I'm actually doing a talk in a couple weeks at online test conference about this specific thing. There's no fully automated test setup, right? Like the goal that a lot of people have, I think, is to just like fully automate testing, don't need human beings, just set it up and, you know, never need to touch it again. Regression testing is great for automation. You know, smoke testing in production, non-write operation testing, right? You don't want to write anything to the database with automation in production because that can easily go awry and you screw up your production database. Usability testing for manual, exploratory testing for manual stuff, one-off testing, you know, should be manual. Early stage development should be manual. So I think you got to be in the right spot. If there's a bunch of stuff that you do over and over and over again, you're spinning a bunch of wheels and your company, you know, is at a certain place and your team is at a certain size, then yes, automation makes sense. But I think there's always just a really important balance there between manual and automated testing.
I think you always need both, right? Like it's not an either or thing for me.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, I almost see, you mentioned this earlier, like in an early stage company, it's like, the founders are ultimately the manual QA people who are like, we're testing to make sure this shit works because we got to go sell stuff. We got a meeting with a customer. We got a meeting with investors. Like, I got to make sure all these things work, right? That's how it starts.
Right.
But you need QA people that are more product focused. They understand how the product's supposed to work and they have actually some input to all that, right? Like they're really in the loop of how the product is supposed to work and are manually testing the things that are being done. You know, there's probably some argument that you can use like no code QA these days. Like I've used Rainforest QA and some things like that make it really easy to make scripts. And, you know, you could things that you would manually test, you could probably build those really easy to do kind of no code QA for some things. but it doesn't make sense to do those for a lot of those things. Like, for example, recently my team worked on like, okay, what is the character limit of the field? Like, you can only type in 20 characters or whatever. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense to build automated QA for every field on the screen and the types of inputs that are allowed and how long the inputs are and like things like that you would kind of just manually test. To me, it makes a lot more sense to smoke test stuff. Like you said, like, can I log in? Can I go here? Can I add something to the shopping cart? Like whatever the things are, you absolutely need a battery of those kind of smoke testing through all the critical things of the system, right?
Yeah. But
I imagine, do you have some clients that are talk about like 100% test coverage? And I guess that gets into like unit testing as well, not necessarily the same thing as like QA testing or integration testing. But do you have some clients or like, we want to test every single possible thing there is?
I mean, I think some of them think that's what they want before we talk. And then, you know, I'm just very honest that I don't think that, I mean, for you're right, for units, the test coverage in my head is unit testing, right? Which we don't do, which I think is a developer driven test mechanism. And they know their code, they just wrote, they should write the unit test. Yeah, we've run across those that they're like, we just want full automated testing. That's all we want to do. And, you know, I try to very gently break it to them that you're always going to need people, man. Like, machines don't have context. You see it with ChatGPT and everything now. Like, it's a great tool. There's lots of great AI ML tools, but they lack context. And people have that context. And it's much easier for, especially things that change, you know, like as soon as something changes, you have to go maintain these tests. Like 30 to 50% of the time testing engineers bill is for maintenance, like updating the test that they've already written. And it's like, what value are you really getting? So absolutely 100%, you should automate stuff, but I think there's a really important balance. Like you said, you need to really understand what's your ROI on it, right? Like, why are you doing it? Are you doing it because you think you should do it? Or are you doing it because it's actually saving you time and money?
Well, I think there's also a big difference between unit testing and that type of testing, which is more code level testing for those who aren't super familiar with it. And manual QA and automated QA testing. So for example, unit testing a lot of times is like in the weeds, kind of like, how does the watch work? How is the sausage made kind of thing, where you, it doesn't replace the fact of like, what does the sausage taste like at the end? Or does the watch actually tell time or not? Like, you still need like this final QA that is sort of the end-to-end integration test, right? Like, I put this thing in, I get this thing out. You can test all the bits and pieces in the middle of like how the machine works, but you still got to test putting things in and getting things out in like a real world test, right? Yeah. So to me, unit testing does not replace that real world test that is still needed. And that's where QA comes in. And I'm a big fan of integration testing. And for example, I own a company called At Capacity that does digital marketing technology stuff. And the hardest thing for us that we don't have any testing for, that I wish we had more testing for, but it's really hard to build, is like our integration with Google Ads. Mm-hmm. Like we create ads on Google and do all these things. But building a test for that is complicated because you'd have to like automated, like create a new account with Google every time that was clean and then like have sort of these sterile tests that you would run through, like this giant battery. That's really difficult to do. Those sort of integration tests. Do you guys do those kinds of projects as well?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, we work with a lot of fintech companies that have a ton of integrations. And, you know, there's enough tools out there. There's enough processes in place where you can do that stuff. Again, it just depends. Like, is the juice worth the squeeze, right? Like, is it worth spending the time? Because it takes time to set up and it takes time to troubleshoot and test the tests. And to your point, like, at the end of the day, would that really save you enough time, or would you be better off just to pay somebody to do it manually? Like, I, you know, you got to run the numbers and figure it out for yourself.
It's really hard. And the challenge is, like, for the example of our Google integration, there might be 20, 50, 100 different scenarios of things that we'd like to test that would be better to automate, because I don't know if I trust somebody manually to do all of them exactly the right way every time. Right.
Yeah.
But it's just too difficult probably for us to automate those, all that stuff. So the answer to all this is it depends. Like everything in IT and software development, QA, all the answer is always depends. There is not one right answer for everything. It depends on the type of product, the type of software development, all the different things, the industry you're in, the stage that the business is in, right? Like if we're sending software to go from here to Mars, we ought to test the shit out of that thing, right? Because it ain't coming back. And we can't hot fix it. Like it ain't never coming back, right? We got to test the shit out of it, right? That's totally different than the my startup weekend thing. I built this little thing I put online and nobody uses it. I don't need to test it at all. And then there's every scenario in between.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. And it's that's also why, I mean, I feel like you're making a sales pitch for me there, but like that's also why you need people to give you a true answer, right? Like that's why people work with us, because I will tell you what level of QA I think you need. And like I've done this like hundreds of times for hundreds of platforms or hundreds of clients. Like I will be honest with you and tell you, yes, we can help you. No, we can't. And if we can, here's the path we should probably take. And if, you know, I'm a trusted partner, I can deliver those results. So I agree. I think you need somebody to kind of point you in the right direction sometimes in those kind of complicated scenarios.
Well, people come to you because they need somebody they can trust, right?
Yep.
And it's and for a lot of companies, they're like, I don't know what to do. I need to find somebody who's an expert at this, that I can trust their opinion and they can guide us the right way. And kind of like at Full Scale, people come to us like, we need help hiring software developers. How do we do this? We trust your help, right? For the same reason people come to you, you're like, I don't know how to do QA or what to do. Please help me.
Right. Yep.
Well, I do want to remind everybody, if you need to hire software developers, Full Scale is a good resource for you. One other thing I wanted to ask you about was, how is business? Like how is the economy affecting you? You guys growing, you're hiring? How is business climate for you?
Business is great, man. Like I hate this analogy, but I can't stop saying it. It's like, I feel like we're like a funeral home. Like you're always going to need QA, right? There's never going to not be enough software for me and 1,000 other agencies to have work. When the economy's bad, when it's great, we've never really had this brick wall. We don't need VC funds. So like that stuff doesn't affect us. Business is great, man. Like I, you know, and since I've, you know, I'm blessed to have a really, really, really great team. My job is to focus on biz dev and sales and marketing. Like just get clients in the door, fill the pipeline up, crush discovery calls, get them, you know, get people excited to work with us. So, you know, that's life is good, man. It's a great business to be in. And I think anybody that works in a piece of software development can drill in and have success regardless of what the climate is.
We're seeing the same thing at Full Scale. You know, we've got about 60 clients and, you know, there's some that the economy has taken a beating on some of our clients. And so, you know, we've seen some ebb and flow from some of our clients, but we talk to new people every week that are looking to hire developers still. So we're growing, we're hiring, we're hiring more developers in the Philippines and continue to grow. But it's I agree with your sentiment. Like there's never ending amount of work to be done. And there's still will always be a shortage of talent. Like there's just not enough developers, QA, and all these other people in the world.
Well, they're never going to stop making software. No. They're never going to stop, like ever. So I think we're fine.
Making, and for your sakes, bad software.
Right. And software for us to make good. So yes.
So let me, one of the last questions I have for you is, so you know, earlier in your career, you're doing QA, you start this professional services business, you're doing QA for other people. And now you figured out your whole job is actually sales.
Yes.
What is that like?
You know the same thing, man. It's not even a tough pill to swallow. It's just like a weird thing to realize eventually. And I remember very specifically early in my career with this business, people would go, oh, you're the sales guy for your company. I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, that's like, what are you talking about? Like, it's dumb. I'm not a salesperson. And then eventually I realized, like, oh, I am the salesperson. Like, that is my job. My job. Is to bring clients in. That's it. That's it. That's my whole job, right? Like if I do what I'm supposed to be doing, it's put other people in a position to be successful. hire people that are smarter than me in different areas of business, let them do their thing, just bring in clients, right? And that's what you kind of get to eventually, I think. And then, you know, people hire salespeople and everything else, but I think the successful kind of excited entrepreneurs never leave that biz dev role, right? They're always looking for the next big thing.
You realize now that you went from doing QA and enjoying it and then helping everybody else do a QA to realize like now you're a salesperson.
But I love it, man. Freaking love it. I love it so much because I like, and somebody's, you know, you hear a million pieces of advice on how to be a good business owner or salesman, but it's like, once you do really make that pivot in your head and you convince yourself that you're actually helping people, it's not sales anymore.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
How am I helping you becomes just a total mindset shift. And you're just like, how am I fixing your problem? It just takes a lot of the stigma and the negative stuff away from the sales side.
So that's what's fun about this is, you know, you become kind of the face and the brand, right? And I'm kind of the same way for Full Skill, you know, for those who follow me on LinkedIn and my blog and all these other things. I'm curious for you, for this type of company and like Full Skill, sales is hard, right? Like you don't really run ads. Like people don't really respond to cold calling and email and all those kinds of things. How do you attract customers? Is it primarily networking, referrals, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. It's referrals. But I have a pretty strong drive for outbound and outreach, sales. Not a huge inbound marketer right now. I like the process of account-based sales. I like finding people who I think would be a good fit and then figuring out how we can kind of get in contact and how to help them. So yeah, it's networking, outbound sales, but really targeted outbound sales. We do some, you know, some cold email blasts and stuff, but for the most part, I really try to focus on bigger and better accounts that I think we can help, be successful.
Well, that's good for you that outbound is working for you. Outbound is, you know, traditionally really tough for, I think, a lot of software development agencies and QA agencies and stuff like that, I would imagine.
Yeah. I think if you compete in the cold game, it is tough. But I don't know, man. If you start local, like, and by local, I mean Philadelphia for me, which is like a pretty big target.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a few of them there, it becomes my clients are my biggest salespeople.
Just right? Warm intros. It's not cold. It's not cold meetings.
And even if it's cold, but you can still be like, I work with this guy in Philly and everybody knows that guy. And they're like, oh, well, hell yeah, I'll work with you because you work with them. It's like you get some kind of key pieces together and you can just, you know, spread that out.
Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate having you on the show today. Again, this is Jay Agner and his company is JDAQA. Check them out at jdaqa.com. If you're like, man, I really need somebody to figure out how to solve all our crazy QA problems, Jay is the guy. If you need help on the software development side, you can keep Full Skill in mind too. So Jay, I always ask people, do you have any final like words of wisdom or tips for other entrepreneurs out there? And it doesn't have to be about QA, it could be about business or anything else.
I say this a lot. Just do it, man. Get off the chair, get off the couch, get off the whatever. Just if you want to start an IT consulting or IT services business and you have any experience, just start getting customers. Start reaching out to people and saying, hey, I can help you. Let's have lunch and just get out there.
I love it. And I love recommending to people to create professional services businesses like ours. Like it's a great way to get into entrepreneurship. So
yeah, I agree.
All right, Jay, thank you so much for being on the show today. Again, everybody, you can check him out at jdaqa.com. And thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Matt.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button. Then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.